In 2011, the St. Olaf Choir celebrated its 100th anniversary. As part of the year-long celebration, we sat down with a group of choir alumni from the last 50 years and talked to them about choir history and tradition and how the legacy of the choir lives on in their daily lives. As we conducted these interviews, a singular voice spoke through the years, connecting a tenor from the class of 1957 with a soprano from the class of 2010, an alto from the class of 1947 to a bass from the class of 1980. Each voice coalesced into a common connecting thread of family and an involvement in something much bigger than their particular years dedicated to the choir. We present to you the story of the choir told in its own voice, a voice that reaches over the years to embody 100 years of one choir, the St. Olaf Choir. Part 1. Auditions. We'll be hearing from William Satry, class of 1983, Anne Sorensen Behrens, class of 1970, Lois Simon, class of 1946, and Kari Werdahl, class of 1982.
Well, I don't think anybody joins the St. Olaf Choir. I think you you have to audition.
I was petrified. We had two levels of auditions. One with Dr. Chris Johnson, sort of a screening interview, and then if you made it through that and you made it to callbacks, then it was a very intimidating situation in Steensland Hall, where the current choir, the existing choir, sat up in the seats, and then those who were auditioning stood on the floor and did all together and did sang things and exercises and repeated patterns and so forth for Dr. Chris Johnson. And then it was very tense as he came around and pointed to those people who were going to make it. And you did it by sections, and I'm sure that's still the same way it is done today in terms of, and I sang first alto, so you sat through the first soprano and the second soprano and watched all the other people endure this process.
And my mother loves to entertain, and so she had out to dinner, the dinner before they sang that night. I had F. Melius and Orff and Miss Lynn and P.G. Schmidt out for dinner. So my father, as usual, said, "Lois, won't you play?" So I played for them, and after a while, F. Melius said to me, "Lois, you're in. You must come to St. Olaf."
So then I auditioned, and then I saw my name on the recall list, my freshman year going into sophomore, and I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. So I went in there, and I still to this day I'm not sure how to sing Praise to the Lord, because we kept singing it, "What do you want? What do you want? What do you want?" And it was, and I never got to cross the line that year, but I thought, I'm just honored to be here. And that's where I was. Then the next year I had re-auditioned and made recalls and crossed the line. And I'll never forget that Karen Trout, if you're out there, if you're listening, she was one of the soloists for the Beautiful Savior, and she was a year older, and I kind of worshipped her from afar, and as soon as I crossed the line and was in, she came right over to me and she said, "I'm so glad you made it. I was rooting for you." I'm like, oh.
Part 2, Christmas Fest. We'll be hearing from Gabe Roll, class of 2010, Jason Enquist, class of 1979, William Satry, class of 1983, Anne Sorensen Behrens, class of 1970, and Rebecca Coates, class of 2004.
I want to say that my experience with rehearsing for Christmas festivals almost paralleled the way that I learned to appreciate Christmas Fest as a child, because those rehearsals are so long and so hard. After a while, I was like, oh, no, I have to go to another Christmas Fest rehearsal that's going to take up 2 hours of my night. Oh, no. And, like, it was a problem for a while, but it was around sophomore year, so it was really quick. Like, freshman year, that was annoying. And then, like, the very next year, it was, like, that became part of the routine, part of what was normal and what made me feel like I was home and this is family. This is my grandfather. He's here, and this is also my friends. And this is the music here, and now, and this is Christmas.
We, of course, everybody had to come back right after Thanksgiving, early, before the other students who were not involved with the Christmas Festival to rehearse and get it all prepared, because it was usually the first week in December. And they were grueling rehearsals, and everything had to be memorized, and often, you know, they would tape. Well, not often, but I think every 3 or 4 years they would tape for PBS, so you even had to look good. Never mind sound good on the radio. You had to actually look good because it was going to be on television. I think that it was an incredible thing, you know, that all of these students had the time at that busy time of the year to be able to give even more time and put this thing together. And it's, you know, been a long-standing tradition.
I remember going to the very first Christmas concert when Skoglund was brand new, when it was first built. And that was the second Christmas concert I'd attended. The first one was the last year they had it in what is now the theater building. And that was the gymnasium. And that's where the Christmas concerts had been for decades. And I remember... I was little, but I think I was six or seven years old. It was very, very hot and crowded. It seemed like they crammed as many people into that gym as they did later into Skoglund. And I remember how exciting it was that first year it was at Skoglund. And that was, by the way, the last year that Olaf Christiansen was the conductor of the choir.
Invited my parents and didn't know the whole ticket situation. And this really is going to show how old I am, all right? The first Christmas festival, I was in the Manitou Choir, and it was in what was then the old women's gymnasium, and that was a very packed place that I'm sure would not necessarily meet fire standards in terms of the number of people who were crammed in there. And I did not have tickets for my parents and my brothers and sisters. And I think the day of the concert that they were going to come to, I happened to mention that to Dr. Jennings, and he acted appalled that they didn't have tickets. And I still didn't realize, because I'd never participated in one, I didn't realize what a popular commodity a ticket was. And so he was able to secure tickets for my parents, because they were already on the road driving to Northfield to see this Christmas concert, not knowing that they could have very well made that trip for naught had he not helped us out.
I remember one time I was asking my mom why she liked Christmas Fest so much, and she turned to me and she said, "Gabe, I like Christmas Fest because this is Christmas for me. This is when it really starts."
I was both the robe lady and a member of the alto section of the St. Olaf Choir. A fellow member of the alto section had become ill over that past summer of 1998, remained ill into the fall, and so the St. Olaf Choir was to make a trip to Minneapolis to sing for her. The night before we were to get on that bus to sing for Greta, I couldn't sleep. I was filled with so many thoughts and emotions, not the least of which was the heartbreak of how very ill this young woman was. I found myself at the sewing machine, rummaging through the purple thread and scraps of fabric used to repair the robes and the flippers and collars. I found myself crafting a small purse-like pouch. using the soft purple velvet robe scrap for the outside and lining it with the white satin flipper fabric. At the time, I remember thinking, is this a sacrilege using this fabric for something other than the robes? Greta, I thought, if you can't come sing with us and wear these robes, then with this gift, the feel of these robes will hopefully come to you, along with our gift of singing to you. I placed a large silver bell into the pouch and wrote a note with words borrowed from the Polar Express, something to the effect that I hoped the sound of the bell would continue to be heard by those who truly believe. She died in April of 1999, and the St. Olaf Choir sang at her memorial service. Years later, in 2009, when my son, Gabriel Rall, sang in the St. Olaf Choir alongside Greta's brother, Tom, I met up with their father. Mr. Frank told me then that they still hang the purple pouch purse and bell on their Christmas tree each year.
Part 3, Touring and Traditions. In this section, we'll hear from Jason Enquist, class of 1979, Lois Simon, class of 1946, Warren Olson, class of 1965, Scott and Kari Werdahl, class of 1982, Jim Ernest, class of 1958, Gabe Roll, class of 2010, Anne Sorensen-Behrens, class of 1970, and Anna Friedman, class of 2007.
The first tour that I went on was my sophomore year, and we were touring down to the Southwest and to California. Made our way down through Denver and into New Mexico, and then eventually, and we sang at the in Tempe, Arizona, at this auditorium built by Frank Lloyd Wright, that was the Gamage Auditorium, Olaf Kristjansson was in the concert, was in the hall that night, and he was wintering down there in Arizona at that time. And I remember it was a big deal because we were doing some kind of secular repertoire for the first time, the Liebeslieder waltzes of Johannes Brahms. And I think Dr. Jennings was kind of nervous about how that was going to be sitting with Olaf. At least the choir was talking about that. And then we went on to California, and I remember we sang up in San Francisco at the St. Mary's Cathedral, and then we chartered a flight and flew back right away and had a concert at Orchestra Hall. And it was all very quick to get back and hop on a bus and go right to Orchestra Hall and sing a concert, and then all of a sudden we're kind of back home. That was my first year.
Well, our bus was supposed to take us. We were supposed to have a bus taking us to Spokane, Washington, and the bus couldn't get through the snow. So the train came from Minneapolis, just an engine, a baggage car, and two passenger cars and a caboose. And we went through the Rockies on this train, which was quite nice. We were, a lot of us guys stood out in the baggage area, looked at the beautiful mountains, and got to Spokane just in time to hurry up and get to the place where we gave our concert. And we were there for that, but that was kind of exciting.
Then the next year, we went to the West Coast and took along this little portative organ, which the college had built by the Hendrickson Organ Company from St. Peter, Minnesota. And it was designed by St. Olaf graduate David Engen, who was at St. Olaf, I think, in the early 70s. And this organ was designed so that it would go up into the Greyhound bus that we took on tour and turn, and they took the first seat out, and that's where it would sit while it was being transported, and then it would come out and go right onto the stage. So we took this organ along to the West Coast, and by the time we got to Colorado Springs, it needed a major tuning, so they brought in an organ builder, and in this little organ, it had what is called the historic short octave, where it's not a full octave, and the pipes are hooked up to keys that are not the same notes as you would have on a piano. but it's a very historic thing, and you get used to playing it that way. Well, the organ builder thought that it was wrong, and they rehooked the keys to what they thought were the right pipes, but they weren't. So I was the very first thing that happened when we walked out on stage. I played an organ piece as kind of a prelude to set the key, and then we went into this early works. And all of a sudden, in Colorado Springs, these notes started coming out of the organ when I was playing them that were wrong, and Dr. Jennings glared at me, you know, and I couldn't figure out what in the world. And then I realized about 30 seconds into this piece, oh my goodness, the organ builder must have rehooked the trackers to the wrong pipes.
We were at a little town in possibly, had to be Iowa, because the war was going on and they couldn't get gas. So we went to a little town and we walked in there. In the school building, and they had a big auditorium, and the auditorium was ringed in black curtains all the way around. And we sang there, had a stage, so we came out on the stage and sang, and they made the announcement before we sang. They said, now we have all of our black curtains on. We don't think that there will be any type of air raid, but in case there just might be, the lights might go out, so don't worry about it. We're on top of it. We got our wardens out there watching, so we're sure you will be safe.
As we were dressing to get ready to go over to the Lincoln Center by bus, we could look down from windows, maybe about the eighth floor of the hotel we were in, something of that sort, and just see mayhem down on the streets. And I think our hotel was maybe about a block and a half away from Carnegie Hall, but the crowds gathering for the Beatles were just unimaginably large in terms of anything I'd ever seen up to that point, and maybe since. But sometimes on that trip, and none of us had very long hair, we would walk into, say, a drugstore in Toledo, Ohio, or some other places, and people would look at us and ask if we were the Beatles.
But then when we had the last concert, I think it was in San Francisco, we flew back. We didn't take buses because of the time, so we flew back to Minneapolis. And this little organ, unfortunately, was put on the plane upside down. Well, when they opened the doors to tune the organ at Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis, all the pipes fell out on the floor. And this was an hour before the concert.
So we sang there. In the middle of it, the lights flicked off. So we kept singing in total darkness. And when we finished our song, we were still singing when the lights went on and they clapped as you never heard, because we sang in the dark and we never got lost.
One of the great Sinola Choir traditions on the bus is every morning B.J. Johnson would sing the Good Morning song, and he would, you know, choose a person in the bus to sing it to every day. Sometimes if it was someone's birthday, he'd sing it to them, and that was always special. And, you know, Beach was always our little happy, wonderful, you know, manager who always brought a bright spot to the day, and I'm sure he continues to make people giggle on the bus in the morning. So singing the Good Morning song with Beach was always hilarious, and we, of course, added our own, you know, dirty lyrics to it, and that was always fun.
So we were in dressing rooms that had high iron bars so that people could hang their gowns and their formal wear on those bars as they were dressing to go on stage. And Olaf, I remember, was in very good form that night and came into where we men were dressing, and what inspired him to do this, I don't remember, but I think he was joking around a little bit, which was unusual for him, and at least in our presence. And at one point, he went over to where one of those bars was and started doing one-handed chin-ups. And none of us could believe it. And I don't think there were very many of us that could do even one, let alone, I imagine he must have done 3, 4, 5, maybe even as much as 10 chin-ups one-handed.
It was on our free day, a bunch of us had gone out to breakfast in a restaurant in New York, and we're all sort of huddled around our table, you know, having our breakfast, and then all of a sudden one of our group sort of like casually whispers over to us, he's like, hey, isn't that Barbara Walters over at another table? And somebody at the table, we're all just like, oh, is it really? And one of them, one of the guys at the table, perks up and he's like, oh my gosh, it's Barbara Walters, like shouts it across the restaurant. And of course, Barbara Walters at this point, because it was her, looks rather irate. She looks over at our table and she's like, who said my name? And, you know, we're the choir here, we're visiting. And it's really neat to meet you. And she's like, well, you all seem like very decent, good people, so it's okay that you bothered me during my brunch.
I did not react well to Wiener Schnitzel. We saw the Passion Play in Oberammergau, but we did a lot of, you know, a lot of churches would provide meals for us. And they all seemed to think we need the true German experience, which was Wiener Schnitzel, and it made me sick every time I ate it. So I spent a lot of time not feeling well, and it was an extensive tour. It was, I think, 28 days, and so we were gone a long time. And I spent, every time we would come back to Germany, we'd get more Wiener Schnitzel.
Tours went well. We went to East the year I was in, up in New York. We were in Town Hall, and then we wound up in Washington for concert in Constitution Hall, and we had a reception. Hubert Humphrey was there, I remember, and various dignitaries. And then we went over to the White House during the day, and there was one of St. Olaf grad that was connected with some of the folks there in the White House. So we went into the main part, the Oval Office, and sat in the president's chair and all that. And then Olaf, of course, they're there with us. And in came Richard Nixon, but he was vice president. And Robert Montgomery was with him. Robert Montgomery was a Hollywood actor, which Eisenhower kind of had as a consultant for his TV appearances and so on. So Olaf asked if he'd like to hear us sing, which he did. So then I can't remember what number we sang, right there in the Oval Office. And then Nixon cracked that we did all this without a piano. Nixon was a piano player, so he kind of added that to it, and of course everybody thought that was pretty good. So, but they treated us royally in Washington. They got us an escort that would lead us around town. A couple of motorcycle cops came and helped us around, and it was a very enjoyable experience. So we got to tour around and see things as well as do the concert.
I don't know when they started holding hands during the singing, but that still goes on today. And so it became popular to pass things down the rows during the singing, during the performance. Well, I was entrusted with the pitch for the Adoramus Te Christe of Giacomo Corsi. Then the applause was starting to wane, and I'm thinking, come on, who's got the pitch? Where's the pitch? And then I realized I was supposed to be blowing the pitch, and I had an egg in my hand rather than my pitch pipe.
And I'll never forget singing in Corpus Christi. We were juniors, but I remember that afternoon we had some free time, and one of my buddies decided to purchase a toy, and it's one of those children's toys. It's an animal toy. It's in a can. So if you turn the can over, it makes a sound. Well, he happened to purchase a cow, a toy, and thought this would be fun to bring on stage. You know, as kind of a passing gesture as we hold hands, which was not uncommon. So this fellow put wrapping paper around it, and he happened to stand right next to me, so I knew what was going to happen. And we're singing, not a very big choir, people are not paying attention, and we're singing, I think we're singing Randall Thompson's piece, but there's a break between a measure, maybe a two or three note break. So we're singing, all of a sudden, moo. We hear this moo from the tenor section, and all of a sudden Kenneth Jennings' eyes went right to the tenor section, blazing blue, and my friend who was standing next to me just was shaking.
Part 4. In this section, Helen Larson, class of 1944, Scott and Kari Werdahl, class of 1982, John Helgen, class of 1979, and Laura Sampson, class of 1987, share some final thoughts on what being a member of the choir has meant to them, and also offer some advice to current members.
I think I gained a lot of confidence in my own work. I think that St. Olaf gave me friends that were very dear to me all my life.
My senior year, when we did our last concert, it would have been during graduation weekend, and we did our concert, and I remember just crying because I couldn't do it again. That was it. You know, I would never be able to sing with the choir again. And there was, you know, they had alum that would come up and sing at that concert, and there was an older lady that turned to me and she said, "You know, you're not part of the choir anymore, but you're part of something much bigger. And there's all of us for all those years that have been in the choir, and you're part of that now." And I remember kind of in my youthfulness and my selfishness thinking, I don't want to be part of that. I want to be part of the choir. And just kind of having a hard time with that. But, you know, here I am 25 years later, and I understand what she means. I mean, I'm part of just an amazing history of an amazing group. And it's just a privilege and an honor to be part of that bigger group that she was talking about. And now I finally can appreciate it.
Never take it for granted. I think Kari always reminds me, well, she didn't go to Norway, but, you know, when you're in the choir for three years, you start wondering, you know, is this, you know, this is getting kind of tough. I mean, these tours are long, and I don't think I ever took it for granted. But once you leave St. Olaf, you know, you think, I'll never have this experience again. But there's so many good choirs out there.
When you leave this place, you know, take that talent and that training that you've had, that you've been so gifted with, and go out and use it well and share it with people.
That was the most special moment, though, of last week. I got to sit in the same row as my daughter, her second row, and there's Dr. Jennings doing Beautiful Savior, and I'm watching her sing in the little choir right down the row. It's like, oh, look at all these generations.
It was such a joy, and it was so exciting because, you know, I'd come from a little town in Minnesota, and here I was playing these huge instruments in these major concert halls all over the country, and it really was quite something.
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy financially for my parents to send me to St. Olaf. But I was determined, and the Lord opened up a lot of doors, and there I was. I used to walk around the campus, and I remember just walking around the campus going, I can't believe I get to go here. And I can't believe I get to sing in this choir. I mean, how amazing. I get to do this. I want to do this. And what a blessing it was for me.
We hope you've enjoyed this look back at 100 years of the St. Olaf Choir. The show was written and produced by Sean Tonko. Original interviews were conducted by Miranda Bryan and engineered by Jeff O'Donnell and Joshua Wyatt. Special thanks to our interviewees who took the time to tell their stories: Ann Behrens, Gabe Roll, Brian Ohm, William Satry, Roger Tenney, Diane Mancini, Eric Swenson, Jim Ernest, Scott and Kari Werdahl, Rebecca Coates, Johanna Hansen, John Helgen, Laura Sampson, Warren Olson, Jason Engvist, Helen Larson, Anna Friedman, and Lois Simon. Music for the program provided by the St. Olaf Choir. You can find these and many other recordings at stolafrecords.com. From all of us here at St. Olaf College, thank you for listening.